and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. And five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs, with a focus on fears and sex. And let's, oh my gosh. Please give a warm welcome to Chris L. from Oceanside, New York. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you. My name is Chris, and I'm a recovered alcoholic. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you for everyone doing service. Thank you, Sunny, for reaching out. And I'm grateful to be alive and sober. My sober date is September 26, 2014. I'm a member of the All It Up Again group, which is in Baldwin, New York, in Long Island. I have a sponsor. His name is Jamie. He's out of Long Beach, New York. Currently working with a number of sponsees that I just love and absolutely cherish. And I'm the business chair for my brick and mortar home group. I share that because I'm taught that I'm an alcoholic that needs all that Alcoholics Anonymous has to offer: the three legacies, service, unity, recovery, service, having a service commitment, unity, having a home group, recovery, as was just read here, the steps we took, which is suggested as a program of recovery. If I am the real alcoholic, as was brought to my attention during step one, then I'm going to need this whole thing. And I understand how important it is, because I not only know that I'm an alcoholic because of my first step experience, but also because when I don't apply these spiritual disciplines in my life, I experience untreated alcoholism. I'm restless, irritable, discontent, and prey to misery and depression, full of fear, unhappy, can't be of real help to others, can't control my emotional nature. I struggle with personal relationships. That's in the middle of addiction, of active alcoholism and untreated alcoholism. Life gets so painful when I was drinking that I have to stop. But when I stop, life can get so painful that almost the thought comes to my mind that maybe I could do this thing right. And I have suffered from untreated alcoholism in my 9 years of sobriety. And I'm grateful for the opportunity to be around alcoholics like myself that hold each other accountable, that rather step in my feelings than rather step in my grave, you know, that hold me accountable, that love me enough to be honest. You know, I love the topic is fear and sex, because it's been quite a journey. You know, the book says we're in the midst of progressive illness. We get worse, never better. And as this disease is progressive, I also believe it's my experience that the solution is also progressive. And just to really briefly qualify about me being an alcoholic, I am an alcoholic. I have a sponsor that guided me through the first step. He taught me about the physical allergy, the phenomena of craving. The main problem centers my mind rather than my body, and I have a spiritual malady. And he had me identify out of a big book the symptoms of alcoholism, and can I relate to them? Do I think like you people? Do I drink like you people? Do I not drink like you people? Do I feel like you people? And my experience was 100% yes. I'm the type of alcoholic, when I talk about recovering from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, it was so seamless that my best friend took me out of my apartment one day and brought me to a church. Essentially, from what I recollect, and I reach out to the people that have touched my heart, that have influenced me in early sobriety. Every anniversary, my goal is not to worship me and give thanks to all that I did, because that breaks the 12th tradition. And I'm not sober because of what I did, but there were a lot of people that planted seeds in me, including my best friend, Kevin, I've known since fourth grade. And he brought me to essentially like a church and a convent. And he woke up a pastor in the middle of the night, asked the pastor to take my penance. And he's telling me this story because the book talks about having hazy recollections, and I vaguely remembered it. And I said to him, why did you do that? He said, for so many years, I was trying to help you live better. At that point, I was trying to help you die more peacefully. You know, I'm the alcoholic, that this disease was killing me. And everybody knew it other than me. When, you know, when the book says, you know, the alcoholic life seems to be the only normal one, that was the case for me. I didn't know how bad things were getting until they were so bad that I'm grateful for the people that planted seeds in my life that brought me to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there were so many people I give thanks for. That didn't lose hope, but at the same time did lose hope, because I knew I could not get sober. I came to AA after years of therapy and EMDR, DBT, Gestalt, all this stuff, healing masses, you name it, I've done it. I found my I'm adopted from the country of Colombia. I found my biological family in active alcoholism. I've tried to fix this inside vacancy with external stuff. Spending your life climbing a building, getting to the top of the building, and you realize you climbed the wrong building. And doing it over and over and over again. thinking that maybe if circumstances okay, I'm going to be okay. The book says, resting satisfaction and happiness out of this world if I only manage well. That when I saw that line, I'm like, my God, that's me. That is 100% me. And it brought me to the place of daily alcohol consumption, blackouts, and all this other fun stuff. But it was quite a hoot looking back at it. But at the same time, I'm grateful that you guys promised me that I could recover from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. That though I may have temptations in times of my sobriety, that I'm not going to act on it. Right? The 10th step says, "If tempted, I recoil. If it's a hot flame, I react sanely." That sanity has been restored as a result of this program. I think different. I act different. I don't get thirsty. And if do I tempt, I recoil as if it's a hot flame. I was taught, the importance of service, the importance of sponsorship, turning my thoughts to someone I can help, prayer, meditation, and that's why I'm here today, to give thanks. Yesterday, I had beautiful conversation with a good friend of mine, and we were talking about stuff from active alcoholism, and this is stuff I haven't talked about in a long time, and I just got consumed with gratitude as to how far this program has taken me, because sometimes I forget and I take advantage and I forget like how bad were things really. And I remember how minute my problems are today because I've been so spoiled with 9.5 years of sobriety. And but I'm grateful that what I went through is now an asset to myself and to the people around me. I'm no longer a victim of alcoholism. I'm a demonstration of, what God can do, right? The book says God will demonstrate through us what he will do, and that's been the case. So specifically focusing on the emphasis of fear and sex. So the book says, to right our fears, I did a resentment, I did a fifth step inventory with a sponsor, George, out of Queens Village, and he had me write a f resentment inventory, which in this case was a four-column inventory, a fear inventory, which was essentially writing your fears. The book says, why do we have it? Well, isn't it because self-reliance failed us? And a five-column sex inventory. And with the fear inventory, I didn't really realize how afraid I was. See, I had normal, which for me was like depression and anxiety, and then I had anger. I didn't really have fear. I'm the type of guy that was, I was burning myself. I was self-mutilating, and my mentality was, you can't hurt me any more than I've hurt me. That was my mentality. I was the last person to be afraid of fights. I was fearless because that was my mentality. I would torture myself literally, knowing that you can't possibly put me through anything worse than I've already done and experienced. And it wasn't until doing this four-step inventory, this fear inventory, that my sponsor helped me realize, helped me dissect the amount of fears that I really had. And I didn't understand. I didn't know. He helped guide me. He gave me examples of fears and, are you afraid of this? And we talked about it. And I started to realize that, the book says, driven by 100 forms of fear, self-seeking, self-pity, self-delusion. I started to realize that, maybe I was afraid, and it looked like anger. It was almost like having feelings behind feelings. It was anger, but behind every anger was a fear. It was something, when the book talks about, wasn't it because self failed us, right? Self-manifested in various ways, which is, had failed us, right? And I started to realize that a lot of my resentments had been attached to a fear of you taking something out of, which essentially was my third column, my self-esteem, my pride, my personal relations, my sex relations, my pocketbook, my ambition, my security. And I didn't really understand, right? The book says men of faith, of courage, to trust their God. We let God demonstrate through us what he will do. And for a long time, I struggled with this whole idea of fear and faith. And how often would I go into meetings and they would talk about, fear versus faith, and you can't have one and the other at the same time. And for I would always like say, like, well, what do you do? How do you get faith? What do you do to get faith? And I'd have some guy tell me, well, you just be. And that didn't make sense because how do you, I need to do something. I need to fix something. Talk about self-will being the director running the show. What can I do in order to get this desirable outcome? Page 87 says, be quick to see religious people are right. Make use of what they have to offer. And I remember meeting this guy at a place where I go to see where religious people are right. And I was talking to Jimmy, and I said, Jimmy, I'm like, what's this fear versus faith thing? I don't understand it. How do I get it? And at the time, I got sober when my son was 1.5. He's turning 11 in April. And I said to him, like, Jimmy, I don't understand this fear versus faith thing. And he said to me, Do you ever pick your son up and throw him in the air and catch him? I said, of course. He said, does your son love it? I'm like, oh my God, my son gets so excited. You hold him up and he's a little baby and you just let him go and he gets all excited and his eyes light up and then you catch him and he hugs you. And he's like, well, does your son get excited? I'm like, yeah. He's like, have you ever dropped him? And I said, no, I've never dropped him. In fact, the higher I throw him, the more happy he gets. And he said, your son has faith in you. And his faith in you is based on experience that he has with you. He said to me, explain to me, he said that the faith is based on a relationship and the relationship is based on experience. So if you want to grow in faith with a power greater than yourself, you have to continue to have experience. Continue to pray, to continue to meditate, continue to read the literature, do what's suggested to grow this relationship, right? Page 164 talks about make sure your real reliance is always upon him, right? We understand that this program, one of the byproducts of this program for an alcoholic is we don't pick up that next drink, which tempted we recoil, in conjunction with a tremendous amount of other promises that have nothing to do with alcohol, that have to do with spiritual stuff and emotional stuff and mental stuff and in conjunction with not picking up that drink, which therefore would not cause the phenomenon of craving and stimulate the other aspects the physical allergy, entails. But this program is nothing more, nothing less than having a relationship with God. In fact, it tells us in our big book about, right, it talks about the personal stories in the back of the book and how they write from their own point of view and their own way, the way they establish a relationship with God. And he said, how you grow in faith is to continue with your relationship. And the deeper your relationship is, the more your faith is. And if the book says men of faith have courage, they trust their God, there's a correlation between the relationship I have with God and the lack of fear. Because we agnostics tells me, right? I've been a worshiper of money, sentiment, things, people. See, I've had faith with things, but the question is, like when we talk about surrendering, it was brought to my attention years into my sobriety that I it's not. Well, I struggle with surrendering. Do I struggle with surrendering? Have I not been surrendering to something ever since I was born? I've been struggling, surrendering to a lot of things. The book says I've been surrendering by 100 forms of fear, self-seeking, self-pity, self-delusion. I find I'm surrendering to defects of character. So I'm not really surrendering for the first time in this program. I'm in essence reallocating that of which I'm surrendering to. As I continue this relationship with God and continuing to reallocate that of which I surrender my life to, God builds a resume of what he can do for me that I couldn't do for myself. And I look back at that resume and I say, my God, look what he did. And over a period of time, I gotta say, these fears have dissipated. The book tells me, and I'll never forget this, I so grateful to sponsor. I was so grateful to be taught that you don't get spiritual and then you sponsor, and that's a byproduct of that is spirituality. You don't get prepared. God will prepare you. God will demonstrate through us what he will do. And I'm sitting with a sponsee, and we're doing a fear inventory. Now, to give you a little bit of idea of how powerful of experience was, my mom invited my siblings and I over for dinner with my dad. And none of the spouses were invited, and the kids weren't invited. It was just myself, my sister, and my brother, and we're having dinner together, and we're sitting on a couch, and it seemed like one of those like experiences that like your parents are about to have like a family discussion with you, or somebody's in some serious trouble. What did Chris do again? It was one of those things, and we're adults, so we're having this. So we're sitting on the couch, and I was just, what's up? This is weird. What's going on? And my mom tells me that she went to a doctor, and the doctor had diagnosed her with something that looked like it was going to kill her. She said it was brought to her attention that she has this illness, and this illness is very progressive and very aggressive, and she's not sure, how much time she has to live. So we cried. We all cried. I stepped out to my dad's office, and I just needed to breathe and cry, and my mom came over to me, and she said to me, she gave, I'll never forget it. She gives me a hug, and she said, thank you for doing what they told you to do. Thank you for allowing me to be honest with you without having to worry about you killing yourself. And she hugged me and loved me, and I was so grateful for this program because back in the day, she would never have been able to do that. And for a few days, I was struggling. I was struggling with fear. I was thinking about what I should have said and what I should have done. And I'm sitting with this sponsee a few days later doing a fear inventory. And my sponsor goes, we're doing this fear inventory, and the book says we ask God to remove our fear and direct our attention to what He would have us be. And I was taught asking God, it means pray. And what would God have me be? Not do, but be is a meditation. So I'm doing this thing with the sponsee, and he goes, hey, Chris. He goes, did you do this when your mom told you she may have been dying? I started laughing because I've been struggling for a few days with this fear about my mom, and I never considered actually doing what it said. So him and I go over his fear inventory, and I go over and I rewrite my own current fear inventory. And we both take some time to pray and meditate. Now, at this juncture, what ended up happening was my mom was put us kids in and a few other people in a group text to give us updates about the doctors and the feedback and the tests and the this and the that. And every time mom was talked about, it was about her illness and about the doctors and about her numbers and about. And what came to me in prayer and meditation was stop being her doctor, start being her son. So stop focusing on the text and it says we ask God to remove our fear. That's a prayer. And what he would have me be, what he would have me be is my mom's son. So I'm going to reallocate the role in which I'm playing my mom's life from doctor and consultant, which I am not qualified medically in any way, shape, or form. Half of the time she talked, I didn't know what she was talking about with all this medical stuff. And I'm just going to focus on loving her as she loved me when I was sick. See, when I'm active in alcoholism, she prayed. She couldn't fix me. She was just there to love me and pray for me. And that's all she could do. When the time was right, she helped me. Maybe I could reciprocate that to her. So I stopped focusing on the illness and I started focusing on the relationship that I had with my mom. And I remember reaching out to her regularly and not saying, how are you? Are you dead yet? Started saying, like, sending her pictures of her grandkids, taking her out to lunch and coffee, being the son that she needed. Because my fear is not about, my fears are self-centered fears. It's how is this going to affect me? What should I have said? What should I have done? Is it too late? What am I going to do without her? See, I can't really, I struggle for me to think of, to have fear without thinking about me at the same time. So, because I am what I never even considered would, if I'm focusing on my fear with my mom, what is she going through? See, these are things that in a self-centered place, I was never considering. What was the pain she's going through? I'm talking about, oh, how it's going to hurt me for losing my mom. But what type of fears is she going through? Have I been there for her to support her, to hug her, to let her cry on my shoulder? Over a period of time of doing what I was told, reallocating, in the 10th step, it says, watch out for selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, afraid, right? Fear. Ask God to remove it, discuss it with someone immediately, make amends promptly. And then it says, resolutely turn my thoughts to someone I can help, reallocate my attention from that of which I'm afraid of and how it's going to affect me, and start focusing on, well, who I can love and who I could serve and who I can give. And I started to do exactly that. And the fear started to dissipate. I wasn't focusing on the illness. I was focusing on the love of my mom who was there and alive. A few months later, they found out that it was a misdiagnosis. So she was fine. And he taught me how to be a son. Taught me that I can have fear without being jerk, because that's the problem. It's not that I have fear, I'm not going to have fear. It's that I'm not going to be driven by fear. I can experience anger and not be driven by resentment. I can experience fear, but not being driven by this, driven by fear. There's nothing wrong with having the emotion. I was taught it's okay to have an emotion. When I'm sitting at my grandfather's wake, I was taught, yes, you don't have to go run a gratitude, write a gratitude list immediately so you could feel better. It's okay to experience fear, but I'm not emotionally driven by fear. And that's the thing when the book talks about being a prey to misery and depression and full of fear. I can have feelings without my feelings having me, because it's an experience that one can have, but it doesn't saturate my soul. It doesn't dictate my next action. And that's been my experience with the fear inventory, that over a period of time of going through this of these steps and growing and understanding and effectiveness in a relationship with God, my fears, they tend to dissipate. They're not as intense. They don't last as long. I tend to not act on them. I tend to not be driven by them. I identify them in a 10th and 11th step. Where am I afraid? Where am I afraid? It's not a coincidence, a 10th and 11th step, which requires for me to look at the things that the fourth step has me look at: resentments, fear, and selfish and self-centeredness. And the power of prayer and what's happened over the last, 9 years and changes. I'm starting to trust God more than trust my fears. Because either way, see, if I'm experiencing fear, I have faith in my fear. But if I have a relationship with God, I can choose to have faith in God. What am I going to choose to have faith in? That of which I'm afraid in, or that of which I've been establishing a relationship with? And over the years, there are plenty of things that have happened that could have warranted fear. But this program, as I said, it helps me not saturate in it. I do trust God. I've seen what God can do. In July, I got laid off, and I, and nothing happened. I just got promoted. Work was going great. I got a raise. Everything's fantastic. And I was really doing well. And we knew there was going to be some layoffs happening. And my director says, "Chris, I promise you, I'm closing the lights with you. You're amazing." And 2 weeks later, I get laid off, and it wasn't her choice. It was the choice of the head guy, global guy, who doesn't even know me. So I experience it, and I'm like, okay, well, this is not a rejection. This is a redirection. God's going to use this thing. I have to not be the director running this show, and I'm going to let the boss be the boss. I've done this inventory before, and I could trust God. And for a while it was great. And then for a few days, I was getting a little self-pity stuff and a little fear stuff. And that's, I think, my experience is that with faith, is that as I grow in understanding and effectiveness, it doesn't mean that I'm never going to have it, but it also helps me find out, for me, these fears help me find out what are the, Mark Houston talks about areas of agnosticism. I trust God, but what, like, for me, my biggest thing is my kids. Most any fear that I have somehow is connected to my children. And I know in the last 9 years and change of sobriety, that's been the one area that's so hard to give up. It's so hard to not want to control, to not feel the need to control. And that's, and I'm aware of that. But I also know that God is working with me and through me, and this is something that's going to be progressively getting better. And the truth of the matter is that, I got a job, I got a great job, I got a raise on top of the other stuff. And but again, how long am I going to sit saturating in that fear? Am I going to be driven by it? So that's my experience with the fear inventory. But the sex inventory, the sex inventory, I remember when I did it, I didn't understand the format of it, and I didn't. When I went through the steps, and this, I'm very much, as you could tell, a big book enthusiast, because the directions are in there, and it was my lack of, and I could say, like, my first year, I felt amazing. Year two and three, I was getting my teeth kicked in sobriety, because there was a lot of things I was missing, a lot of directions I was missing, a lot of prayers I was missing. There was a lot, right? It's a design for a living that works in rough going, and it's a spiritual toolkit laid at my feet. Well, there was a lot of tools missing in this, in my program. Until I dove in. I was trying to build a house without hammer and nails. You could only imagine how well that was going. And so I do this little sex inventory, and it's I find my first sponsor on my I can't even say his name without crying. That guy saved my life. But the one thing I didn't do in early sobriety was dive into the book. And I didn't understand the book to probably about 3 years sober. I don't know what I was doing, but I certainly wasn't reading this thing. And I'd probably say one of the biggest areas that I missed information was the purpose of a sex inventory. And I was taught that the sex inventory is not essentially about the action, but about relationships, where did I arouse jealousy, bitterness, and suspicion, right? That's who I write on the sex inventory. Yes, it talks about the some are on a straight pepper diet, and some will have no flavor for their fare, and some will be on a straight pepper diet, and it indicates that there's an aspect to the behavior of sex. But I was taught it's not limited to, it's about self-centeredness and relationships, and I really didn't understand it. And to be honest with you, I get sober, and my mentality year one was, as long as I don't drink, everything else is okay. And the truth was that at that point, I was having, I was having an affair at that time. I had a daughter with one woman and a son with another woman. And there was a lot of, as I said, fear about kids, fear of losing kids. That wasn't lust driven. That was fear of losing kids driven. I was deathly afraid of losing kids. And as a result of not living up to a sane and sound ideal for sex relations, I ended up losing my daughter, Isabella, because of my fear, and that I let it drive me, and that I didn't apply it right. It says we put it to the ultimate test. Was it selfish or not? I was selfishly acting in a lot of behaviors and in a lot of relationships, and I just didn't get it. So this particular part of step four or five, I learned the hard way. I can honestly say I really learned the hard way. And when I do it with sponsees, we do the four columns and we get to the last column, which is, what would God have me do instead? What would God have me do? Not instead, because that to me that associates shame and guilt, but what would God have me do moving forward, right? We're going to ask God to shape a sane and sound ideal for future relationships. We're not looking at this. I like the analogy is like, when I was potty training my son and he peed all over the floor, I didn't yell at him. I just reallocated his direction so he could hit the little plastic toilet thing. And for me, an act of alcoholism, I'm peeing all over all my relationships, and God is using my past to mold me to get to hit it, to hit the target, right? And that was something that, as I said, I've learned the hard way about. But I'll tell you, I realized over the years how self-centered I was. There's a wonderful link called Fish Love. And the guy's talking about this, this young boy who's eating a plate of fish. And he goes, young man, I see you're enjoying that fish. And he said, oh, I love fish. He's like, oh, you love fish so much that you took it out of the water, you chopped its head off and boiled it. And now you're eating it. You didn't love the fish, you loved yourself. That when I heard that, I was mind blown. Because that literally describes every relationship I've ever had. It's how can this person fulfill something in me that'll make me feel better? How can I find a wife that's aesthetically pleasing that will fulfill this requirement? I have a scroll of needs that need to be met, and they need to fulfill as many of them. And then I'm going to compare this one to the other ones. And literally every relationship I've had was completely self-centered. I thought I knew how to love, realizing I knew nothing about love. That link helped me realize like how little I know. What does it look like to have a love like that, to have relationships in my life that are only focused on giving rather than receiving, right? And that's like, as far as I'm concerned, one of the main themes of the St. Francis prayer. It is in dying that I receive everlasting life. It's in that sort, giving that I receive. It's my job isn't to be forgiven, but to forgive. What would it look like to have a relationship just based on how can I serve you, not about what you can do for me? And that's been a trip. That's been a huge trip. And for example, and I know I have a few, like 3 minutes left, so I'll get up to the end. So I talked about losing my daughter at 3 years sober. Well, last Christmas, one of my friends from Be Quick to See Religious People, all right, make use of what they have to offer. He was doing a fund for women that were abused and their children for Christmas. So I'm going to meet up my friends at the driving range to go golfing, and I was there early, and I'm like, you know what? Let me go to Target and I'm gonna go buy some kids gifts because that's what we do. We give. I'm the arbiter of what God gives me, and my job is to give. And so I went out and I went. I went Christmas shopping for toys for little kids, and I had a great time. And I'm sitting on the line, the checkout line, with to buy these toys for the kids. And I look up and I see my daughter. And I haven't seen her in years. I haven't seen her in about 6 years. And I see her brother. And I flip out. Like I'm on the phone and I'm like, oh, I'm on the phone with a friend of mine. I'm like, oh my God, I'm looking at my daughter. I haven't seen her in years. And she's with her father. There's a resentment attached to that one. At least not her real father. So I'm on the phone with a friend of mine, and I'm like, I'm looking at Bella right now, and man, he just immediately jumped into prayer, got me into that space. How can I serve thee? Thy will be done, and we did a quick inventory and like, what would God have me do? I love where it says, And I'm going to read it. I don't want to brutalize it. We treat sex as we would any other problem. In meditation, we ask God what we should do about each specific matter. What would God have me do about this? Would he have me go up to the guy that's been playing her father for, 10 years of her life and go up to the brother and say, oh, well, she's my daughter, my daughter, not his daughter. So therefore, they're like half sister, half brother. No, of course not. And I see her and I prayed and I thanked God for giving me the opportunity to see my baby girl. I walked away and cried. But I do know that God won't, doesn't want for me to write the books as the rule is to be hard on ourselves, but always considerate of others. My job is not to interfere in this girl's life. I tried every which way to get her in my life. It wasn't, the stars weren't aligning. She wouldn't take child support. She wouldn't do a paternity thing. And quite frankly, she was happy with her situation. She has a wonderful mother and father. Who am I to jump in her life and disrupt their whole? That's what God is telling me, that it would be selfish for me to interfere in what they have going on. And if it's going to happen, it's going to happen organically, the way God wants it to do, not me being the director running the show, trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, and the scenery. Because I want my daughter to be happy whether or not I'm in her life. That's what I want. That's what true love is. That's what you guys taught me. My prayer for me and for all of us is, as we go through this relationship with God and continue to grow in regards to how to treat other people, is the ability to put other people first. And I know that's for me the biggest reminder. Love, 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 love. Don't give, don't worry about receiving. Just focus on giving, and everything will take its course. And that's what you guys taught me. And that's the last thing that I knew how to do. I'm a selfish, self-centered, self-absorbed alcoholic that's been given an opportunity to focus on loving. And as a result of that, you guys have given me so much and the opportunity to be sober. Thank you for letting me share.